Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's good to see you. We've got a lot to cover today. We have a limited amount of time. What you'll be hearing in this presentation is a very compact version of what's taking me literally 27, 28 years to learn. I've interviewed dozens of people, read thousands of pages of books, watched a number of documentaries, and still get new information every week on this topic of global warming from my confidential sources. This topic, as far as the U.S. government is concerned, is one of the most highly classified matters that the government deals with, highly classified and highly compartmentalized. People will sometimes flippantly say, well, an organization like the federal government of the United States can't keep secrets. Well, I assure you that they can keep secrets. Absolutely they can. The example I use is the Manhattan Project. The Manhattan Project was the project to build atomic weapons in World War II. Literally, tens of thousands of people, including my father and my grandfather, both worked on the Manhattan Project. Very few of those people had a clue what they were doing. My father and my grandfather were plumbers, and they worked down in Oak Ridge, Tennessee on the Manhattan Project. Yes, indeed, the government can keep secrets. And this matter of the truth behind global warming is one of the most important secrets that they have. The first thing I will ask you, I'll ask you this question. Would the federal government of the United States of America lie to you? That's the response I expect. Laughter. Of course they would. And they have for decades. Because of what I do and what I do professionally, I interact with people involved with law enforcement, including the FBI. I was working on a project with a couple of FBI agents, and we're having lunch one day, and we'd gotten to know each other a little bit. And I thought, well, I'll ask this guy the question, what happened with John Kennedy when he was shot? Now, the man I was asking, this was not just a run-of-the-mill FBI agent. He was a supervisory-level FBI agent within a few years of retirement. He's now retired. And I kind of put him in a box because if he told everything he knew, he was jeopardizing his career and his pension. But if he said, John, the Warren Report was exactly accurate, then I would know that he was a nutcase because nobody believes the Warren Report. So here was his answer. It's a very creative answer. This is from a supervisory level FBI agent regarding the Kennedy assassination. His answer was two words, creative forensics. Now, that let me know that he knew what every person who's looked at it carefully knows, is that the Kennedy assassination was not what we've been told it is. A couple of personal things when it comes to secrets and how military intelligence knows about things before they happen. First week of May, 1967. I'm 19 years old. I'm in a military intelligence school. And I got assigned for a Sunday morning, what they call a dining room orderly. My assignment was to be in the officer's mess where they served breakfast on Sunday morning, stand at parade rest, and whatever the colonels and the majors wanted, if they wanted coffee, I go get it. If they want toast, I go get it. Stand there at parade rest, eyes straight ahead, and just wait on the officers. One colonel's talking to another colonel. Now, this is military intelligence school, and these are field-grade officers in military intelligence. First week of May, 1967. One colonel says to the other colonel, you know, those Golan Heights are going to break loose any day now. First week of May, 1967. What happened 4 weeks later? The Six-Day War. Yeah, they knew. They knew. Fast forward just a few months, September 1967. Now, I see some folks in here old enough to remember the Tet Offensive of 1968 in Vietnam, end of January 1968, which took place only 2 months after General Westmoreland gave his famous light at the end of the tunnel speech to a joint session of Congress, December 1967. where General Westmoreland told the joint session of Congress that Viet Cong were defeated on the battlefield, could no longer mount a credible offensive. I get to Vietnam in 1967 in September. By the end of September, I knew about the Tet Offensive at the end of January 1968, 4 months before it happened, 5 months before it happened. I knew about it, and I was getting ready for it. Everybody else found out the last week of January 1968. You better betcha, the people in military intelligence, they know about things before they happen. I know about things before they happen, even now, because I've maintained my contacts inside military intelligence. What you're going to learn today is known by the major world governments. I doubt the president of Zimbabwe knows what we're going to talk about. But the heads of England, Canada, United States, Russia, China, they all know, and they're making preparations. The Vatican knows, and I have some local connections there that I know how about the Vatican and what they're doing. The Fortune 100 companies, they're getting ready and being prepared. My firsthand awareness began in year 2000. Two different men, friends of mine, they're both researchers. They approached me and they said, John, there's this thing that's going to happen. We're not sure about the date, but it's going to happen. When it does, there's going to be abrupt climate change. There's going to be 200-mile-an-hour winds. There's going to be massive tidal winds. And I said, yeah, sure, give me a break, you know. But I knew these men well enough that I trusted what they told me, and I went to a confidential source, and I said, check this out. I need to find out if this is true. And my confidential source, a friend of mine, he says, oh, John, you know, that's silly. That can't be real. But he trusted me and knew me well enough to check it out. He gets back with me a few weeks later, and he says, John, it's exactly what you said it is. It's coming. It's going to hit us. It's going to hit us hard. And there's going to be 200-mile-an-hour winds. And there's going to be massive tidal waves and earthquakes and all the rest of all the things that you said. That was in the summer of 2000. Here we are 9 years later. Today being March the 29th, 2008. My research has continued. I've continued to develop my sources and put the whole thing together so I can make presentation. I've got copies in the lobby that I'll make available for anybody that wants it. It's a Department of Defense study done by a private think tank about abrupt climate change. Now, the Department of Defense spent many thousands of dollars to have this private think tank put this paper together. And I've got a quote from this, and this, what I've got out here that you can get is the open source unclassified version. The classified version I haven't been able to get my hands on. But here's the first paragraph of that paper by Peter Schwartz and Doug Randall. Recent research, however, suggests that there is a possibility that this gradual global warming could lead to a relatively abrupt slowing of the ocean's thermal halon conveyor. That's the Gulf Stream, ladies and gentlemen, which could lead to harsher winter conditions, sharply reduced soil moisture, and more intense winds in certain regions that currently provide a significant fraction of the world's food production. With inadequate preparation, the result could be a significant drop in the human carrying capacity of the Earth's environment. That means people are going to die. That's what that means. Has anybody seen the film The Day After Tomorrow? Anybody? Okay, a few. There's some science in there and some science fiction. If you haven't seen it, I would urge you to get a copy from the library, borrow a copy, whatever it takes. The opening scene is something, it's a dramatic interpretation of what really did happen, which was Larsen Ice Shelf B breaking away from the Antarctic continent. That really did happen. Very dramatic event. Now, some of the science in there is what will be happening in the future with abrupt climate change. The science fiction in that film is what's going to cause it. And the science fiction is human activity creating CO2 greenhouse gases. That's the science fiction. There's three characters in that movie. They're oceanographers. and they're on a little island off the coast of Scotland. And quite frankly, they could be anywhere because you can do this from your home if you've got internet access. There's buoys out there in the Atlantic that give 24-hour, 7-day-a-week readings of the ocean temperature. And anybody can do this anyplace. You don't need to be on a little island off the coast of Scotland. So they're sitting there watching the ocean temperatures off the coast of Scotland. And then there's a dramatic drop in temperature on one buoy, then another buoy, and so forth. And what they're watching is the North Atlantic Thermal Hailing Conveyor, which is also called the Gulf Stream. From my private sources, I know that in real life, not in Hollywood films, but in real life, PhD oceanographers, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, are actually doing that on both sides of the Atlantic, and they're very, very concerned. Just a couple of years ago, there was an announcement in November of 2005 that the Gulf Stream had slowed down by 30%. My private sources tell me it's been more than that. Now, here's the deal. You look at a map of the world, and you've got England, Ireland, and Scotland here, and you've got Moscow here. They're both the same distance from the North Pole. They're both the same distance from the North Pole. England, Ireland, Scotland, and Moscow. What's the difference? I mean, they rarely see any serious snow in England, Ireland, and Scotland. They don't have furnaces like we do because it doesn't get to be 10 degrees. And they certainly don't have the winters of Moscow, even though they're the same distance from the North Pole. The reason they don't is the Gulf Stream. The Gulf Stream is that ocean of warm water that comes up from the Caribbean, the Gulf of Mexico, up the east coast of the United States, goes over and down past England, Ireland, Scotland, past France, goes on south and makes a big circle. That's the Gulf Stream. That's what gives England, Ireland, and Scotland the very temperate, mild winters that they've always enjoyed. The best PhD oceanographers on the planet know that it's slowing down, and they know it's going to stop. There's some disagreement about when. And because there's some unknowns that they have to try to do some guesswork. But here's what makes the Gulf Stream work. It's the salt content. It's the salinity of the ocean. The salt content of the ocean allows that big engine to pump that water up, go over and come back down, and do that big circle of thousands of miles. The salt content is changing because of melting freshwater ice in Greenland and melting freshwater ice in the Antarctic. Now, the melting ice at the North Pole doesn't make any difference because that's floating salt water. So it doesn't make any difference. When it doesn't change the sea levels, it doesn't change the salinity of the ocean. This fresh water being introduced into the ocean is reducing the salinity of the ocean. That's slowing down the Gulf Stream, and at some point, it will stop. 3 years, 5 years, 20 years, I can't tell you when. And the best PhD oceanographers on the planet can't tell you when. They can tell you it's about to happen, though. And, of course, that brings abrupt climate change. What does that mean? Well, it means they have to turn their furnaces up a little bit higher in England, Ireland, Scotland. I wish it was that simple. When you're in the construction business, and I've been around the construction business, my family business was plumbing, you learn certain things. You learn certain things about infrastructure. You learn where the frost line is. You bury pipes below the frost line. And all the pipes in England are buried below what they call their frost line, which is probably 6 to 10 inches, because they don't have any real winters there. The frost line here is 18 inches in Missouri. The frost line in Moscow is probably 2 to 3 feet. So, all the infrastructure in England is built to deal with winters that they're not prepared to deal with. All the infrastructure there. The same thing's happening in Alaska right now. In Alaska, we've got the permafrost melting. All human-made, all human-built infrastructure up there, roads, buildings, bridges, pipeline on concrete piers, is built with an engineering premise the engineering premise is that the permafrost will always be, guess what, permanently frozen. Permafrost, permanently frozen. Guess what? It's no longer permanently frozen. And the bridges, the roads, the buildings are all starting to do this. In fact, it's become a full-time job on the pipeline to go back to those concrete piers and straighten them back up. That highway that goes from Washington State to Alaska they built in World War II, that was built on top of the permafrost. It doesn't have a foundation like what we have here. As I started tracking this matter of abrupt climate change and rising ocean levels, I incorporated into casual conversations with people I knew and came in contact with. I was having lunch one day with a friend of mine. This friend is a veteran of the U.S. Navy Submarine Corps. And I was talking about what would be causing this, because I did pretty quickly learn what would be causing the rising ocean levels and abrupt climate change. And my friend starts telling me what he heard at a classified U.S. Navy briefing. And he went on and on about how the Navy had told everybody in the submarine corps about rising ocean levels and what that would mean and why Navy retirees should consider moving to the Arkansas-Missouri Ozarks, because the Navy was telling, and is still telling these men, that the Arkansas-Missouri Ozarks are one of the known safe havens when all these events take place. Later that night, I got home and I was thinking about our conversation. And something occurred to me that hadn't occurred to me while the two of us were together. And it occurred to me that we were talking about the same thing. I was talking about the cause, and he was talking about the effect. At that point, I also remembered a map that a patient of my wife's a chiropractor, had brought in and showed my wife back in the mid-80s. Of what North America would look like after the oceans rose to their new levels. Now, at the time, I thought this lady needs a tinfoil hat real bad. That's the only thing I could think of. It was a beautiful full-color map done by a psychic. But I always remembered the map. I have a very good memory about things that I choose to remember. And I thought about this map, and I called my friend on the phone and I said, I got this map. I want to send it a copy of it. I got a little copy I found on the internet, 4x4 inches. So I sent it to him by email. And my friend looks at it and he says, well, from the Rocky Mountains east, it's very accurate compared to what the Navy showed us, with one exception. Wisconsin's gone on the Navy's map. Wisconsin is still there on Scallion's map, Gordon Michael Scallion, well-known psychic. And from the Rocky Mountains west, it's not even close to what the Navy says, not even a little bit close. So I went ahead and ordered a copy of Scallion's map, a full-size version of it, and I get together with my friend, and he goes over the entire coast of the United States, East Coast, Gulf Coast, around Florida, down to Texas, West Coast on up to Washington. And he shows me in great detail where the Navy said the new shoreline was going to be. He also told me that the East Coast would take damage up to the Blue Ridge Parkway. Now, the Blue Ridge Parkway runs north-south on the east side of the Appalachian Mountains, about 100 miles from the coast. Now, you have to keep in mind, this is not John Moore. This is U.S. Navy in classified briefings telling these men what would be happening in the future. Since talking to my friend, I've also interviewed three more Navy veterans. One was an officer in a submarine corps. Another was an intelligence officer from another service assigned to the submarine corps for a 3-year tour of duty. And a third guy was a Navy veteran. Fourth guy, actually. The intelligence officer, he was kind of an unusual way that the two of us got together. A friend of mine, he's a college professor, and I was at his college class on international relations, giving a presentation on terrorism. The other presenter was this former intelligence officer. So we finish our presentation to college students on terrorism, and we go to a pizza place in Rolla. And there's four of us. Myself, I'm sitting here. The retired intelligence officer, his wife sitting next to me. And the intelligence officer himself sitting across from me. And my friend, the college professor, is right over here. Once I found out that he did a three-year tour of duty with the Submarine Corps, I knew I had to ask the question. I might never see this man again in my life. I got to ask the question. Now, we haven't talked about rising ocean levels. And this you have to keep in mind, this is a basic tool of investigative work, is interviewing witnesses at different times and different places, interviewing witnesses that don't know each other. You want to get to the heart of a matter, that's the way it's done. You find witnesses who don't know each other that have the same information, and you interview them at different times, different places. So I ask him, tell me what you know about rising ocean levels. His wife, sitting next to me, before he can even speak up, his wife sitting next to me says the following. We were on our last duty assignment, and we were at the Pentagon. Now, we've been all over the planet, typical military family, and we had to pick a place to retire. We chose the Arkansas-Missouri Ozarks because of rising ocean levels. I had my answer. We talked about that a little bit more. A few weeks later, I made a lunch appointment with him, and I brought the map with me that I'd revised after going over with the first submarine veteran. I brought it with me. We met at Steak and Shake, had lunch, and I had him revise the map even further, getting a few more details in there. The third submarine veteran, retired submarine officer, he's one of my pistol students. We had lunch and we talked, and he says, John, I signed these non-disclose agreements. If I tell you what I know, I could lose my pension. I have to be out 5 years before I can tell what I know about rising ocean levels. I've only been out 3 years. I said, well, can you blink your eyes once for yes and twice for no? Then you won't be talking. He says, yeah, I can do that. The retired submarine officer verified what the other two submarine veterans had told me earlier, word for word, detail for detail. And he also, this is the third man who had chosen the Arkansas-Missouri Ozarks for his retirement home. The Prophecy Club, a Christian group out of Topeka, Kansas, they sent me on a nationwide speaking tour in 2005 on this topic. And I'm up in Detroit speaking on this. On one of the breaks, I have a man walk up and introduce himself to me. He says, John, I'm in the insurance industry. And we've wondered for years, us in the insurance industry, why is there such a cluster of retired Navy people in the zip codes of the Arkansas-Missouri Ozarks? Now I know. Now I got my answer. The Navy knows. Another pistol student of mine, a retired Navy guy, I said, what's the altitude of your new home? He told me to the foot the altitude of his new home. How many people can do that? Almost nobody. He told me to the foot the altitude of his new home in the Arkansas-Missouri Ozarks. Absolutely he did. How many planets are there in our solar system? Nine? Okay. NASA. Never a straight answer. NASA. July 29th, 2005, announced the finding of the 10th planet named Xena. Do a Google search. They did. Don't take my word for it. NASA announced the finding of the 10th planet named Xena, 29th of July, 2005. Parade magazine and the Sunday newspaper. It was a front cover of the January 15th, 2006 edition. A friend of mine, I started telling him about these matters in 2004. After the NASA press announcement in July of 2005, he calls me up and he says, John, you're not crazy. There really is a 10th planet. NASA said so. I said, thank you very much. There has to be a cause. And this is something, quite frankly, we don't need to address it, but we will address it. The cause is the 10th planet. Now, what NASA is calling the 10th planet is not the 10th planet we're concerned about. It's the 10th plant that's referred to in the Bible, also called wormwood. The closer you are to the current equator, whatever that might be, the better off you are when these things happen, if there's a pole shift, because your climate's not going to change all that much. If you're in Miami, Florida, and we have a 20-degree pole shift, you're not going to end up with a really, really bad winter. You're going to have a mild winter. But if you're in Maine and you got a 20-degree pole shift, you could end up with the weather of Siberia real easy. And when this 10th planet comes through our solar system every 3,600 years, it just causes severe problems on our planet, interacting with the Earth electrically and with gravity both. The back of your paper, no need for panic, there is a number of books cited that you can get from the library or purchase from different authors that talk in great detail about these planetary matters. Professor James McCanning, who is a credentialed scientist, has written a number of books on this. He's a real astrophysical scientist, and he knows about this stuff. I'm a private detective and a researcher. I'm not a scientist. But I can tell you what the scientists say, because I've read their books. And I can tell you what Dr. Velikowski said, because I've read his books. And I can tell you what the Bible says, because I've read the Bible. And all these things are true, and all these things are in the process of happening right now. It took me a while to figure this out, and for the following reason. All these Navy veterans, they were all told about abrupt climate change and rapidly, violently rising ocean levels. And I was trying to figure out in the past 12 months, where is all this water going to come from? Because the men that I was interviewing, they were in the audience, like you guys. They weren't the scientists. The Navy just told these men in these classified briefings what would be happening. They didn't tell them how or why. They didn't need to know. But they told them what would be happening. They told them that these oceans would become violent and have massive, violent tidal waves that would wipe out all areas near the coast. Up until last year, I was thinking, oh, melting ice at Antarctica, melting ice at Greenland. But that, how could it melt that fast? Well, it can't melt that fast, even with what we're going through. It turns out the answer was right in front of me all the time. There's a quote from Velikowski that I'll be reading here in a moment when we get to it. It turns out that the knowledge is something all oceanographers know, and a lot of people in geology departments in every university knows. There is a bulge of water at the equator. Now, we're talking about sea level here. Sea level is measured at Cornwall, England. It's a couple hundred years ago, England was kind of running things when it came to oceans, and they got to pick where to measure sea level, and they measured it. They got a big rock, and there's a line there. Psh, that's sea level. It turns out that sea level varies as much as 494 feet up and down from that rock in Cornwall, England. Now, that's like a 50-story building. I mean, it's a lot of water. And there's a bulge of literally millions of cubic miles, 1 mile by 1 mile by 1 mile, cubic miles, millions of cubic miles of water bulge at the equator of this planet. It wasn't common knowledge for John Moore, I found out. It's not common knowledge for most people. It's held in place by two things, the rotation of the Earth and gravity. Anything that changes our true north, our pole, by more than just a couple of degrees will cause that water to be disrupted. And there's a technical term for it, slosh. And there's records locked up in bones and stone of this having happened in the past. Velikowski talked about it extensively in his books. Talk a little bit about this water damage. You have a map in your hand up. Now, from Washington, D.C. to Boston is basically one big city. Since World War II, that's what it's become. One big city. All that's going to be gone. Going down the coast to Atlanta and down to Florida. Florida, the highest point in Florida is on the panhandle, 55 feet above sea level. Florida's finished, except for a small part of the isthmus, maybe. And that's a big maybe. Gulf Coast, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi are pretty much going to be gone. In fact, the new mouth of the Mississippi will be at the current Arkansas-Louisiana state line, a couple hundred miles up from where it is right now. Going down around the coast of Texas, Texas will take damage about 100 miles inland. California will take damage 25 to 100 miles inland, depending on a couple of things, the level of the altitude above sea level and seismic activity. On up the west coast to Oregon and Seattle, all coastal areas being damaged 50 to 100 miles inland. And once again, seismic activity is going to play a big role in what happens. Locally in the Midwest, we have something called the New Madrid Seismic Zone. Once the Mississippi River becomes 50 to 100 miles wide, the U.S. Navy, not John Moore, the U.S. Navy says it will trigger at least 3 9-point-plus earthquakes on the New Madrid Seismic Zone. Southern Illinois will basically be on one large swamp. In fact, Southern Illinois is already pretty swampy. If you fly over the Mississippi River right now, you can see where the river used to be. You can see where its banks were at one time. A much, much larger river than it is now. I mentioned Wisconsin will be gone. The Great Lakes will become one vast inland sea joining up with Hudson Bay up in Canada. That's what the Navy says. And it's kind of ironic and kind of caught my attention when all of these Navy veterans, these submarine veterans, they all look at this map and they say, John, Wisconsin's gone. It's finished. There's not going to be any more Wisconsin. Florida's gone. Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, finished, gone. Okay, I need a volunteer. Who wants a free copy of my book? Clyde, come on up. You can just stand here, Clyde, and when I ask you the questions, you can give your answers, whatever answer you see fit. You're going to get the book anyway. Okay. Now, I've got some products here in this box, since you volunteered, you're going to get the chance to be, well, heard about lab rats and guinea pigs. Clyde's going to be our guinea pig here. This first product is Spectracide, insecticide. Now, there's a point I'm going to be making here, ladies and gentlemen, and here's the point. Sometimes secrets are hidden in plain sight. If you can't keep it in the file cabinet locked up, sometimes you have to hide them in plain sight. Now, this stuff will kill all these, I mean, pretty much any kind of bug there is. Okay? And it says here, if you swallow it, you should call poison control. I mean, that's reasonable, right? Okay. Now, I've got a Q-tip here. Now, if I open this up, and would you allow me to swab it underneath your tongue?
No.
You don't have to swallow it. Just I'll swab it, and then you spit it out. Would you go for that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I'm scared of that.
Okay. This is a smart man here. Now, I've got two more products in the box there, and they also have insecticide in them. In fact, I'm going to read what the effects are of this. If you get this stuff in you, death, nausea, vomiting, abdominal distress, diarrhea, stupor, weakness, muscular weakness, tremors, convulsions, respiratory cardiac failure. Now, I'll make the same offer to you, Clyde. These two products here, that have this insecticide on it. Just a little swab underneath the tongue?
I think I'll pass.
You pass on that? Okay. Now, these...
I don't trust medicines.
Well, this isn't medicine. This is...
I mean, some of this stuff is bad.
Now, it says right on here, just like the insecticide, it says if you swallow the product, that you should call poison control. Because, in fact, this insecticide and this product, they can't sell it as a separate product as insecticide anymore. It's too dangerous. It used to be. I mean, 40 years ago, they would sell it in pure form for insecticide, but it's too dangerous to even let loose in the environment anymore. But here's the two products right here, Colgate and Crest.
Yeah, fluoride?
Yeah. Sodium fluoride is one of the most hazardous, one of the most dangerous substances known to man. And it says right on the box, right here, that if you swallow it, you should call poison control. That if you swallow it, you should call poison control. That if you swallow it, you should... Well, what about a little swab under the tongue?
Yeah.
You already told me you wouldn't do it.
No, they'd get into your system.
There's lots, especially for children, there's lots of medications that it says put under the tongue. Because that mucous membrane instantly puts it in your bloodstream. Instantly. Hiding in plain sight. That's the point. Thank you, Clyde. And here's your copy of your book. If I can get it without knocking off everything here. Thank you, sir. We appreciate your help.
John.
Hiding things in plain sight. That's the point. If you can't keep it locked up in secret, you hide it in plain sight. Colgate and Crest. There's probably more of that toothpaste sold than any two. Colgate and Crest. There's probably more of that toothpaste sold than any two brands in the country. And it says right on the box, if you swallow the product, you call poison control. First time I did this, it was on live on the air on a radio show. And it was a live call-in show. This lady calls in about a half hour after I made this little presentation. And she says, John, I went to my medicine cabinet, and it says right on the tube, just like you said, call poison control if you swallow it. Here's a couple of things they're hiding in plain sight to make this point. We've all heard the Catholic Church and the Vatican. Of course, the Vatican and the Catholic Church is a country. A lot of people don't think about it, but it is a country. They have their own postage stamps, for example. The Vatican also has, maybe I should use past tense, they had a library open every working day for centuries up until July of 2007. Now, Rome is, 80, 100 miles from the ocean, from the Mediterranean Sea, but it's not very high above sea level. In July of 2007, the Vatican announced that they were closing the Vatican Library. It had not been closed in centuries. Hiding it in plain sight. The reason they gave, the publicly stated reason, was that we have a structural problem in this building and we got to correct that. We're going to shut down the library. It will be reopened in 2010. By 2010, ladies and gentlemen, it will be someplace else. In fact, it's probably already being in the process of being moved. Here's another example of something being hidden in plain sight. I know we have most people in this audience either have internet access or know somebody that does. You put this in Google, CIA in Denver. CIA in Denver. And Google. And you'll find that public announcements from CIA going back into 2007 that they're moving their entire domestic division from Langley, Virginia, which is about 85 feet above sea level, to Denver, Colorado. Now, the first publicly stated reason was kind of silly, and they got tired of being laughed at, so they stopped stating that. I'll tell you what that is in a moment. What they're saying right now is, quote-unquote, for operational reasons. That's the publicly stated reason now. The original reason, we want to break up the old boy network that's been in place for so many decades in the CIA so things will run better. Nobody believed that. That was just too silly. My contacts inside the CIA said, John, we're just scratching our heads. And that's before they got my information. We don't know why we're being moved. They're not telling us. They're not telling us. They're just saying, if you want your career and you want your pension, pack your bags and go to Denver. Otherwise, your career is toast. EPA, our friends. Now, a lot of people make fun of the EPA and hate the EPA, but like most government agencies, most of the people that work there are good men and women with good intentions, including a lot of scientists. The EPA had a library, past tense, until 2007. The library containing the largest collection of cross-reference, important term, cross-referenced articles and manuscripts on man-made compounds and biological agents in the English language. In 2007, it was closed. The EPA library was closed, and it was a number of different locations around the country, closed to even EPA scientists could not access it. Anybody see Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth? Okay, once again, I encourage people to watch this film, movie. There's some science in there, some science fiction. The science is about what will happen in the future, abrupt climate change and rising ocean levels. The science fiction is what's causing it. It's not man-made greenhouse gases, like he says. That's a distraction. And that tactic was decided on many, many years ago, sometime in the late 70s, early 80s, that they would use that as the pretext to keep people thinking things are going to be okay. The science leaves out something, and the science fiction adds something. Al Gore gives a timeline for when these events are going to happen. Abrupt climate change and rising ocean levels. The timeline that Al Gore gives in his movie is the same timeline that the federal government gives out through the NASA Goddard Space Flight Institute. Say that fast 10 times. The NASA Goddard Space Flight Institute, which the Queen, Her Majesty, visited last spring when she was in this country, by the way, because she's got taking a sudden interest in science. Jim Hansen is the director of the NASA Goddard Space Flight Institute, and the timeline he puts out and the timeline Al Gore puts out is the exact same timeline, and here it is. It's kind of clever what they did in the movie, the way they said it. But in 2016, things will start to get bad, abrupt climate change and rising ocean levels. And then about 2050, things will really get bad, abrupt climate change and rising ocean levels. Exact same timeline put out by the federal government through NASA. NASA's part of the military, by the way. If you're noticing space flight shuttles go up, captain this, lieutenant that, colonel, I mean, it's the military. It's always been the military. That's the official timeline put out by the federal government. Now, the real timeline. I found out through my confidential sources what the real timeline is, and I found out why they're doing what they're doing right now, moving the CIA from Langley, Virginia to Denver right now. These relocations, which you could call evacuations, are ongoing right now, due to be complete in December of 2009, about 21 months. They're due to have everybody who's part of continuity of government planning. It's not all federal employees. If you work for Health and Human Services, you're toast. There's no place waiting for you in Denver. People in the intelligence agencies. People in certain parts of the military, not all the military. The scientists, the engineers, the doctors that they want to have in these shelters when everything breaks loose. That's who's being relocated. That's who's being sent to these shelters. These shelters are literally hundreds of millions of your tax dollars where people can live and work and have hot showers and pizzas and video movies for years without ever leaving the place and be quite comfortable. There's other things that could be happening in the next couple of years. Those of us who research these matters and share these concerns, we all know that there's multiple agendas proceeding forward, and that what we sometimes refer to as a New World Order, which will be basically corporations running everything, banks and corporations, they fully expect to come out on the other side of this intact. A fellow radio talk show host from my station, he lives down in northwest Arkansas, not far from Walmart headquarters. He says, John, I get plain brown envelopes with no return address sent to me from people that work inside there at middle and upper management levels, giving blueprints of the shelters that Walmart's built for their people. They expect to come out on this. Another friend of mine was working with a Catholic group here in St. Louis. And his job was to help set up military-grade radio communications between the Vatican group in St. Louis and the Vatican. Military-grade two-way communications. And we're talking 10-4 good buddy CB stuff. The real military-grade radio communications. The agendas of the people that control the world, the international bankers and the Fortune 500 and so forth, is to have a planet with far less people on it than there is now, either inadvertently through these earth changes or by design, through World War III, a flu pandemic, or severe economic collapse leading to societal disruption, or all three happening at the same time. These are all matters that could be happening in the not-too-distant future. What's going on right now in March of 2008? Well, the first 2 months of this year, of 2008, we had 400 tornadoes. I refer to what we're living in right now as Phase 1. Phase 1 is where normal commerce takes place. We can have our careers, interact with our families and our social events that we normally do. And life appears to be normal. The powers that be are using Phase 1 to finish their final preparations. This shelter I talked about here at Walden Springs, Missouri, it took almost twice as long to build it as they anticipated. They kept running into the various problems that any construction project has, but they got it built. And they're using these remaining months to finish up whatever final preparations they need to get their people in place and get moved. Phase 2 will be when these earth changes events, abrupt climate change, bizarre weather, earthquakes, tidal waves, all become so numerous that they become daily news. In fact, when I meet people out in the street, almost everybody comments on how bizarre the weather has become. And that's pretty much a topic of daily discussion. The government, the powers that be, will claim that these bizarre weather-related events are related to global warming. And when they're happening, that we need to start cutting back on our creation of CO2 greenhouse gases. In fact, on the way in this morning, I heard that we had our first Earth Hour in Sydney, Australia. We had our first Earth Hour where they turned off the lights in Sydney, Australia for 1 hour to get people to think about global warming. Since I've been watching these matters the past 9 years, I watched it incrementally become a bigger and bigger media event, up to the point where Al Gore got the Academy Award for Best Documentary in 2007. Then it was like, we're off to the races. Where up until that award, or that Academy Award, global warming-related news stories was maybe twice a week. That was about what I was seeing. Since then, since he got that Academy Award just over a year ago, it's been daily, 7 days a week, global warming stories. And there will be no end to it. As long as there's news, as long as they're capable of broadcasting news, you will have global warming stories every day of the week from now on. As these events become more severe, you're going to hear more and more men with lab coats from NASA talking about global warming being caused by human activity, and that it will be better and everything's going to be okay, so you can go back to your baseball games and go back to work Monday morning. Things are going to be fine. That's phase two. Phase three will be a relatively short period of time. It may be a matter of a few days, maybe a week. It won't be long. At some point, people will realize that things are very strange and very dangerous, and they'll start doing things they normally wouldn't do. Say, for example, you're a professional, self-employed, or you have several people working for you. Half the people in this country work for small businesses. Many of the owners of those businesses are financially well off that they could lock the door and never go back. They love what they do, and that's why they go to work every day. I've heard a number of people tell me, they say, John, the government doesn't want to create panic. That's why they're concealing this. No, the government's not concerned about panic. What the government's concerned about is business owners making very rational, very logical decisions that I'm locking the door and I'm out of here. No panic whatsoever. That's what they're fearful of, because that would shut down the economy if enough of them did it. They want to keep these people in the dark as long as possible. A friend of mine, a gentleman I've known since 1970, 38 years, I made an appointment with him about 3 years ago, because I consider him a very dear friend, and I wanted to warn him about these rising ocean levels. I won't use his real name. I'll say his name is Billy Bob. So I make an appointment to meet him in a coffee shop, and I drive 2 hours one way to meet him in this coffee shop. And we get caught up on marriages, divorces, babies, and grandbabies, and all that. And then I get to why I wanted to meet with him. I said, Billy Bob, did you know that the oceans could be in the hotel lobbies in Miami Beach in 5 years or less? Now, the answer he gave me didn't surprise me, because I know what he did as a young man 45 years ago. And he said, yes, I know. So I took half a day of my life to warn my friend about rising ocean levels, and it turned out he already knew. Now, 45 years ago, when he was in the military, he got involved with covert operations, the real black bag side of the house. And he's been connected ever since. He doesn't get his news from CNN or the newspaper or the Wall Street Journal. He gets his news from the people that make the news. So he didn't need to be warned. He didn't need to be warned. Most men, and it's mostly men because of the nature of the work they do, some women, who know about what we're talking about today, just simply go about their lives and keep quiet about it. They're not public speakers. They take care of their family. They take care of themselves. And the rest of you are on your own. What I bring to the table is public knowledge of what's a very well-kept secret. Phase four will be the end of the world as we know it. Once these oceans come up, the infrastructure that supports normal human activity will be wiped out. Take, for example, shipping, ocean-going ships. The bulky, heavy products of the world, whether it's grain or petroleum products or coal or lumber, is all moved by ship. Ships that go in and out of seaports. When the seaports are underwater, all that stops. It's finished. It's over. That's just one small example of what we're looking at in the future. The housing where 100 million people live will be damaged and or destroyed. The potable water that these people rely on will no longer be potable. The food that they rely on to eat will no longer be available. It will not be a pretty picture. Martial law will be instituted probably before that, which brings to mind these other scenarios I mentioned. Economic collapse leading to social disruption, for example. If things get bad and there's what appears to be a need for martial law related to rioting in the streets over economic collapse, people don't have jobs, can't buy food, people will probably go along with martial law under those conditions because it would appear to be the right thing to do. It would look like a way to get things back to normal. So people will go along with martial law under those conditions. If, however, martial law is instituted because these oceans are coming, nobody's going to pay attention to that. They're going to get out of Dodge. They're going to be gone. And martial law or no martial law, they're going to be gone. If martial law is instituted and there's a lockdown before that, then we'll have a better chance of maintaining martial law. I've lived under martial law for a year in Vietnam. What are you looking at? You're looking at curfews. The curfew could be from 10 o'clock at night to 6 a.m. The curfew could be 24 hours a day. They're under 24-hour curfew right now in parts of Iraq, I understand. Restrictions of sales of firearms, ammunition, and alcohol. Rationing of fuel, rationing of food, potable water rationing, possibly rationing of electricity. We've seen that in Iraq a lot, depending on what's going on. Martial law is not a fun thing to be part of or live under, even if you're part of the occupying force, because it changes your life. Got some interesting questions that we'll go through one at a time here. It was pointed out to me that I talked about the evacuation timeline, but didn't talk about the timeline about when things would be happening. The original evacuation timeline was to be complete December 2010. Now, when you're moving literally tens of thousands of people, their spouses, their children, their pets, their household items, it's no small thing. It's a massive logistical problem. And one of the problems the government has is that this object, this 10th planet, has been acting like a comet, and it's coming up from the south, which is why we can't see it. It's coming up from the southern hemisphere, from the South Pole. It's been speeding up and slowing down. That's what a comet does. When it gets a tail and starts interacting electrically with our sun, it starts speeding up and slowing down. Well, they discovered they had to move up everything to be complete by 2009, by the end of 2009. It's not a specific date as in March the 1st or July the 10th or anything like that. It's not a specific date. It's a time frame. The time frame is 2010. That's the time frame. That's why 2012 is a distraction. Those of us who were involved with the preparations for Y2K, who were observing and watching what was going on, we noticed that almost nobody did anything until 1998. And then in 1999, when most people did something, whether it was buy a case of bottled water or whatever it might have been, or extensive preparations, that was done in 1999. The government knows this as well. So that's why they've pushed these dates on us of 2012 and then later in the century, because they want to distract people. There was a question about Weldon Springs possibly being a prison. That's one of the more frequently heard comments in the metropolitan St. Louis area, is that what they built underground there is a prison. Well, I've been to many prisons professionally, interviewing people incarcerated in various prisons, and you don't build prisons underground. It's way too expensive. Underground construction is 2 to 4 times as expensive as above ground construction. You don't build prisons underground. And everything at Weldon Springs is underground, so I assure you it's not a prison. The Navy says, as far as ocean levels, the Navy says these oceans will come up over a period of about 30 days. Once these events get in motion, these water levels, these oceans, these tsunamis, tidal waves, will take place over a period of about 1 month. There was a question about the United Nations Biodiversity Project in the Ozarks and wildlands programs and different things. There's lots of agendas overlapping and seemingly at odds, but not necessarily at odds once you look at them more carefully. The powers that be want Africa, for example, to be a continent with almost no people, to pretty much become their playground where they can recreate and observe the animals in the wild. And it's rapidly headed that direction between disease and war. Any place where people can survive and live independently, they want to control it. That's, in my opinion, the reason behind all the attention being given to the Ozarks and these United Nations biodiversity projects that they got going on. There's been some questions. Of course, St. Louis is the headquarters for Monsanto, about Monsanto buying up and getting patents on seeds. I think that's what the question had to do with, patents on GMO seeds. And they do. There has been farmers prosecuted, not prosecuted criminally, but sued civilly for inadvertently having genetically modified seeds blown to their fields, and they inadvertently have plants growing that they didn't buy the seeds for. It's a pretty crazy thing. Altitude. The Navy says that everything 100 feet sea level and below will be completely destroyed. The Navy says everything at 400 feet and below is at risk of being damaged and or destroyed. But there's more to this. There's how close you are to densely populated areas. Now, the Appalachian Mountains, for example, in North Carolina and so forth, would be highly desirable places to be if it wasn't for being so close to literally tens of million people who are going to be hungry and without potable water and without electricity. That's what makes those areas undesirable, even though they will be safe in terms of geology and rising ocean levels. There was a question about money and keeping money and so forth. If you're watching what's going on with the dollar, now this is March of 2008, you might be watching this video a year from now, 6 months from now. The American dollar is in severe crisis and is at risk of no longer being the reserve currency of choice for the countries and the major banks of the world. Dollars, if you call dollars money, you would be well advised to maybe be looking at something else for money to store up value for future use, possibly gold coins, possibly silver coins, to store up a lot of value in a compact area, compact space. Before, however, I would get gold coins or silver coins, I think I would look at other aspects of preparedness, and that's why I want to focus on the final part of this presentation is preparedness. On my radio show, I told my audience in the summer of 06 that I would no longer focus on the geopolitical matters. I'm with Republic Broadcasting, and they have a number of excellent talk show hosts that talk about the geopolitical matters nationally and internationally all the time quite well. That John Moore would focus on preparedness. So let's look at the stepping stones, the building blocks of preparedness. First of all, and most important, is spiritual preparedness. I'm not ashamed to admit that I am a born-again, Bible-believing Christian. I know from interviewing and studying what happened in World War II that our American POWs who were incarcerated in POW camps in World War II, our American POWs who had strong spiritual beliefs, were far more likely to survive what went on in POW camps than those who did not. Eating the same food, having the same medical attention, doing the same work, wearing the same clothes, living in the same buildings. Those who had a strong spiritual foundation were far more likely to survive those conditions. We know that for a fact. It's not my job to tell you what your spiritual beliefs should be. My job is to tell you you need to have strong spiritual beliefs, whatever that might be for you. Next comes skills. And there's a lot of skills I'm going to advocate. I'm going to look at my list here so I don't miss any of my list of skills. And I'm going to come back and read you what Dr. Velikowski wrote about what might happen. The skills of a farmer, a gardener. You will be growing your own food. The skills of a paramedic. Now we get so used to, if somebody gets injured, we dial 911, and in a few minutes there's a wonderful, shiny ambulance with these highly trained technicians that got all the stuff they need to save life. In a future where things no longer work like we're used to, you're going to be your own paramedic, or are you going to sit there and watch your loved one bleed to death from a chainsaw accident or whatever it might be? An EMT course is one semester at your local junior college, maybe $100, $200, and you'll know more about emergency medical matters than 99% of the people in this country. You don't need to worry about passing a test unless you intend to be a paramedic or EMT. You don't need to worry about taking a test at all. You want to learn the skills, and you want to get a kit equal to your skill level. Now, the paramedic training is three more semesters of college on top of that first one, and then you'll have a skill level almost equal to a medical doctor when it comes to emergency medical treatment. The skills of a ham radio operator. Now, I've been in places, I've been in combat, and I know what it's like not to know what's going on. This book that I offer on my website, Emergency Survival Communications, excellent book. It's written for people who don't know anything about radios. Sitting someplace when things are bad, let's take an example most of us are familiar with, 9/11/01. By mid-morning of the 11th day of September 2001, I knew we were at war because smoke was coming up out of the Pentagon. That's how I knew we were at war. I set up emergency communications on my dining room table. I monitored the local emergency frequencies where I lived in St. Louis. I monitored the radio frequencies nationally, and I monitored the TV stations for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for about 10 days or so. We finally shut it down. Being able to instantly and effectively communicate with your friends and loved ones, we found this out during Hurricane Katrina, two-way radio communication that you control could mean the difference between life and death. In Hurricane Katrina, it was a matter of life and death for many people. The ability to communicate with their loved ones, let them know they were okay, ask for help, or be able to give help. The skills of a backpacker, being able to carry everything you need on your back, your shelter, your clothing, your hygiene needs. Being able to clean yourself out in the field, prepare food out in the field, and do so in a manner that doesn't make you sick. Being able to take water out of a stream and filter it so you can drink it without getting sick. All the things that a backpacker knows, the skills of a soldier. In a severe crisis like Hurricane Katrina, for example, you're your own cop, you're your own soldier, or nobody's protected. That's what it comes down to. You become your own soldier, you become your own police officer, and you protect your loved ones because of these skills that you learn. Animal husbandry. In a severe long-term crisis, having goats and sheep and chickens and ducks and rabbits can mean the difference between a fairly good and healthy diet and one that's terribly lacking in protein. It's extremely difficult to get the protein you need from an all-vegetable diet. Extremely difficult. The skills of a carpenter, of an electrician, of a plumber. Things that we may call up a professional to do now, you will be on your own to make these repairs. The skills of an automobile mechanic. All these skills take years to learn, and you can't learn them out of a book, at least not and be very effective. There's some things you can learn out of a book, but without practical application, you're just guessing at how this stuff works. Where do you live? I've had a number of questions during our breaks about where safe areas are. The Arkansas-Missouri Ozarks are one of the known safe havens. That's basically the bottom third of Missouri, not counting the Boot Heel, and the top third of Arkansas, not counting northeast Arkansas, that flat area where they grow rice. It's not considered part of the Ozarks. It has altitude. It's well above sea level, averaging 800 to 1,000 feet above sea level, some places a little lower, some places a little higher. A moderate winter, at least for the time being. I hope that continues. Good growing season as a consequence of that. Plenty of water, no shortage of water at all. And distance between where you will be and major metropolitan areas. The two largest metropolitan areas being being St. Louis and Kansas City. A friend of mine, one of the submarine veterans, lives in Mountain Home, Arkansas, very near the Missouri border. He says, "John, we have all these people from Chicago moving down here. All these Chicago cops. Maybe they know something, huh?" If you're choosing a place to live and thrive during a severe long-term crisis in the Ozarks, you may think, well, myself and my spouse, we can do this. Then I remind people who are considering that of the number 168. 168 hours in a week, and in a severe long-term crisis, somebody's going to have to be awake 168 hours a week. Because no people can do that, I suggest that at least six adults come together and decide to shelter as a group. I also suggest that people have at least a two-year supply of food. Professor McKinney, in one of his books, his 60-page pamphlet about surviving Planet X, he mentions the need, the possible future need, to establish a new calendar. It goes something like this. If there would be a pole shift, it would change the seasons, it would change the calendar. In fact, within recorded history, the calendar has changed from 360 days to 365 days. This has happened in the past. If it changes more than 3 or 4 weeks, though, here's what could happen. You could plant your seeds at the wrong time. If you plant your seeds at the wrong time and you can't go to the grocery store to get food, this could be a life-threatening situation. So you need to be able to know when the time to plant is so you don't plant at the incorrect time and end up losing all those valuable seeds. That brings to mind another matter that's in plain sight, the seed banks that are being built. There's some notoriety earlier this year in 2008 about the seed bank opening up in Norway. As close to the Arctic Circle as you can get and still have what might be considered normal human activity built into the side of a mountain. A seed bank where they can store all the seeds from all the plants on the planet, apparently. So they're hiding that in plain sight. Now I need to go back to Dr. Velikowski's quote here. Dr. Velikowski was a medical doctor, and he wrote several books about these matters, and he was hammered on mercilessly. One of the things Dr. Velikowski did was reconcile calendars, like when you reconcile your checkbook. And it's the nature of professionals in all professions not to talk to people who don't do what they do. You know, lawyers typically don't talk to doctors, and archaeologists who study Egypt don't talk to archaeologists who study China. And nobody had ever done this previously. And it's not easy to do, reconcile calendars from these ancient cultures. Dr. Velikowski made an observation. There is a passage in the Bible. The Israelis are having this battle, and they need a few extra hours to win this battle, and guess what? They got a few extra. Their day was a few hours longer. You know the quote, Jim. The incident. Right. Now, typically when we study the Bible, if there's something we can't understand, we just say, well, God's just trying to make a point. You know, this really didn't happen. That's what we do. Up until fairly recently, that's what we had to do with the incident with the Israelis fighting this battle. well, God was trying to make a point that he had the power to do this. It really didn't happen. Well, it turns out we now know scientifically how that could happen, and the only way it could happen, for the Israelis to get 3 or 4 hours more daylight, the only way that can happen is for the planet to roll over in space, giving those extra 4 hours. Here's what Velikovsky said. Well, if the sun didn't set over the Sinai Desert when it was supposed to, on that date, and he had the date because the Israelis had calendars and they wrote it down. That's a pretty important deal. I mean, you know, if you're Moses and something important happens, you tell the scribes, hey, write this down. This is important. So they had written records and they had a calendar. Velikovsky said if that happened over the Sinai Desert, then the sun must not have come up in China the next morning when it was supposed to come up. And the Chinese had scribes, the Chinese had calendars, and guess what? The sun didn't come up the next morning when it was supposed to. Verifying scientifically the Bible and verifying scientifically what really happened. The Israelis did get that extra 4 hours of daylight, and the Chinese didn't have the sun. Of course, the sun couldn't come up because the planet had rolled over in space. And that's why the Israelis, and God can make that happen. And he did make it happen. Now, Dr. Velikovsky wrote a number of books. Now, what I'm going to quote here word for word is a quotation from one of those books is titled Earth in Upheaval by Emanuel Velikovsky. Now, what he's doing here is this is one page of one book. He's giving a very compact, highly condensed observation of what happens in a pole shift. Observations based on what he found going around the planet and finding the evidence. It's titled A Working Hypothesis. Let us assume as a working hypothesis that under the impact of a force or the influence of an agent, and the Earth does not travel in an empty universe, the axis of the Earth shifted or tilted. At that moment, an earthquake would make the globe shudder. Air and water would continue to move through inertia. Hurricanes would sweep the earth, and seas would rush over continents, carrying gravel and sand and marine animals, casting them on the land. Heat would be developed. Rocks would melt. Volcanoes would erupt. Lava would flow from fissures in the ruptured ground and covered vast areas. Mountains would spring up from the plains and would travel and climb on the shoulders of other mountains, causing faults and rifts. Lakes would be tilted and emptied. Rivers would change their beds. Large land areas with all their inhabitants would slip under the sea. Forests would burn. Hurricanes and wild seas would wrest them from the ground on which they grew and pile them, branch and root, in huge heaps. The seas would turn into deserts, their waters rolling away. And if a change in the velocity of the Earth's rotation, slowing it down, should accompany the shifting of the axis, the water confined to the equatorial oceans by centrifugal force would retreat to the poles, and high tides and hurricanes would rush from pole to pole, carrying reindeer and seals to the tropics and desert lions into the Arctic, moving from the equator up and down the mountain ridges of the Himalayas and down the African jungles, and crumbled rocks torn from splintering mountains would be scattered over large distances, and herds of animals would be washed from the plains of Siberia. The shifting of the axis would also change the climate of every place, leaving corals in Newfoundland and elephants in Alaska, fig trees in northern Greenland, and luxuriant forests in Antarctica. In the event of a rapid shift of the axis, many species and genera of animals on land and in the sea would be destroyed, and civilizations, if any, would be reduced to ruins. It paints a pretty bleak picture, and hopefully that won't be what we're in for. I can't stand here and prognosticate exactly what we're in for. I can tell you for a fact that the federal government has been spending hundreds of millions of your tax dollars getting ready for this since at least 1979, at least. That the Fortune 100 companies, or at least many of them, I don't know which ones, but many of them know about this. The major governments know about this and are making preparations. China and Russia both know about this and are taking what precautions they think are important and need to be done. There's a lot of people and a lot of entities that know about this. Now, the two DVD sets I've got out there talk a lot about preparation in the general sense of the word. There's a lot of overlap in preparedness. If you're prepared for a major earthquake, you're pretty much prepared for anything. If you're prepared for a major terrorist attack, you're pretty much prepared for anything. But there's some differences that we're going to cover right now about dealing with what we're looking at here. Anybody here watch Little House on the Prairie, Michael Landon? Okay. Life on the Kansas Prairies in the 1880s, 1890s. In the 1880s, 1890s, we had a complete working infrastructure in this country where goods and services were produced and delivered. Commerce took place. We had a postal system. We had law enforcement. We had a military. We had medical care. Bulk goods were produced and delivered and transported, none of which used internal combustion engines. None of it. None of it. No internal combustion engines. It was all people power, animal power, and steam power. That's what made that infrastructure work. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we may be going back to the 1880s and all that infrastructure is gone. Steam engines are pretty much in museums and not available to the rest of us to use. Although I'm working on that. Horses, there's a lot of horses around, most of them for pleasure use, not many are would be used to or are suitable for pulling heavy wagons, although I guess they could be adapted for that. And what wagons do we have? That whole infrastructure of cargo wagons pulled by horses is pretty much in museums too. Sailboats, bicycles, steam-powered cars, steam-powered boats, steam-powered tractors. That's what we'd be looking at eventually. On my website, you'll see steam engines built by Mike Brown. And I'm working with another manufacturer who's doing something nobody's ever done that we're aware of, and that's fabricate complete steam electric generating sets mounted on a flatbed or an enclosed trailer, where it's all one package. So if you have wood or anything that burns, and if you have a little bit of water, you can have electricity. And that's a nice thing. Electricity is a good thing. And trying to operate communications equipment without electricity simply isn't going to happen, not very effectively anyway. There are some crank-up receivers that you can get, which I have a couple of them myself. Steam power is the way large amounts of electricity have always been generated. A lot of people don't know this, but this young lady might know here, but a nuclear submarine is a steamboat. An aircraft carrier is a steamboat. A nuclear power plant is a steam-generating power plant. That's the way large amounts of energy have always been made, because of the incredible torque and energy you get from expanding steam. So that's hopefully will be available soon, where people can get access to steam energy and steam engines. We already can get the engines, but the boilers are the hard part, and the man I'm working with in Minnesota is working on getting these boilers ready to go, and we're right at the cusp of being able to offer those. Getting access to modern medical care, which I don't advocate except for emergency use, and modern dentistry, which I do advocate, could be very difficult, if almost impossible, to do in a long-term crisis. If you need pharmaceutical products to live, you need to look for alternatives, because access to pharmaceutical products is probably going to be cut off. Getting those concerns taken care of now while you can is an important thing to do. Getting those dental concerns taken care of, stockpiling prescription and pharmaceutical products if you need to do that. In a long-term severe crisis, as I mentioned earlier, if somebody wants what you have, whether it's your food or your teenage daughter, you're going to have to be the one stopping that person yourself. That means learning to use firearms and be good with them, being prepared to use deadly force to protect your loved ones. All right. Most people, if you try to talk to them about this, aren't going to want to hear it. I wrote this paper, "You Have No Need for Panic," for my brother and my brother-in-law, knowing full well that they probably would not pay heed. I've written a couple of times, and I've spoken publicly a couple of times about denial. The Nile is not a river in Egypt. Denial is a very predictable human response. The first time I ran into it as an adult was in Vietnam in the fall of 1967. I mentioned earlier that I was knowledgeable and preparing for the Tet Offensive I knew was coming. Now, if you can imagine, ladies and gentlemen, I was in a small unit, psychological warfare. We had maybe 80 guys. Most of these guys were doing stuff like making the trucks run, running the printing presses, administrative things, and so forth. There was four of us that worked in intelligence, four of us out of those 80 men. Imagine you're working with a guy who has access to privileged and classified information, and he tells you that we're going to be attacked. And you know, because you already know it, that you don't have enough ammunition, you don't have enough food, and the guy you're working with tells you, you better be stocking up on extra food, you better be stocking up on extra ammunition. And that's what I did. I told the men I worked with, I said, guys are going to hit us, they're going to hit us hard with everything they got. The Army's not taking care of us. The Army's not providing us extra food. The Army's not providing us with extra ammunition. You need to be doing this yourself. In September, October, November, December, I'm telling these men the same thing. Almost none of them paid heed. A few did, most didn't. That was my first introduction to denial and my first awareness that people don't want to hear bad news and they're not going to act on bad news. And I can tell the people in this audience, and I can tell the people watching this movie, that most people you talk to are going to respond the same way. Even though you give them the evidence, even though you can show them the printout from Google, the news articles that the CIA is moving half of everything they've got from Langley, Virginia, to Denver, for no apparent reason, no reason that they're willing to talk about anyway, operational reasons, all right? Tens of millions of dollars to move these people from Langley, Virginia to Denver, Colorado. One of my sponsors on my show, he's my only sponsor at the moment, he sells freeze-dried food. And he was talking to one of the larger, if I mentioned the name, you would instantly recognize it, one of the larger manufacturers of freeze-dried food in the country. They may be the largest, I don't know. This was about 6 weeks ago. This is the end of March 2008. So this would have been early to mid-February. And here's what one of the largest manufacturers of freeze-dried food told my friend about 6 weeks ago. Governments, plural, not singular, governments, plural, have come here in the last week or two and bought everything we've got. Everything. Our entire inventory. Anything you want from now on, freeze-dried guy, will be a 6 to 8 week back order minimum, and we can't even promise that. Last minute preparations. There was a story in the news just in the last week about a country storing up tons of corn in a cave, of all things. I guess they don't have silos where they are. In fact, I know this country, and I know they don't have silos. We're seeing some unusual last-minute preparations taking place, and they're happening right now. If I had a better timeline, I would give it to you. I'm not sure anybody has a better timeline. The timeline we know of is enough for me. Knowing that we'll get through 2008 pretty well and most likely make it for 2009 pretty well, that's okay for me. I'll take that 21 months and run with it. Absolutely I will. And every month after that is a blessing from God to do a little bit more and talk to a few more people. Every month after that's a blessing from God and be living on borrowed time, in my opinion. A little bit about Professor McCanning. and what's causing all this to happen. Because I kind of touched on this a couple of times, and we need a bit more detail. As opposed to what NASA says, our solar system is not electrically neutral, as NASA says, but it is electrically charged. In fact, Professor McKinney refers to our solar system as being a massive solar capacitor. And any large object that comes into our solar system will start discharging that capacitor. And that's when the problems start, and it's already happening. This large body that we talked about earlier is interacting electrically and with gravity with our sun and with us directly. All weather, and this is mentioned in the film, The Day After Tomorrow, all weather except for small areas, and we talk about man-made weather, but man-made manipulation of weather can affect a couple hundred square miles for a relatively short period of time. That's what man-made weather can do. But otherwise, all weather on this planet is a consequence of energy coming at us from our sun. In the film The Day After Tomorrow, there was an actor acting as a NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, acting as a NOAA scientist, and he makes this statement. The only place energy like this can come from and at this level is our sun. And that's a true, scientifically true statement. The sun is what's causing our weather to become so bizarre and so strange. Energy from our sun. And our sun is truly going ballistic and going bizarre, becoming bizarre. We've known for many decades that our sun goes through an 11-year cycle. 11 years of increasing solar activity to a high point, and 11 years of decreasing activity to a low point. When it got to the top of the 11-year cycle about 5 years ago, it didn't peak, it kept getting higher and higher, to the point where all the instrumentation that they had set up to measure solar activity had to be recalibrated. They couldn't even measure it. They had to mathematically extrapolate to get the answers they were looking for what our sun was doing. And right now, in March of 2008, our sun is doing some very bizarre and very strange things, which is causing our weather to be very bizarre and do very strange things all over the Earth. And it's happening right in front of our faces. And it will continue to happen. I urge people to get Professor McKinney's books, read his books, and listen to his radio show. Professor McKinney is a scientist who knows what's going on and is willing to talk about it. There are scientists in the government who know about these matters, but they don't talk publicly about them. It would be the end of their careers. There is occasionally a slip of the tongue. I'll give you an example of a slip of the tongue. There is a program for civilians to be trained to observe weather and report back to the county sheriff's office what they observed. Skywarn. Now, a lady friend of mine, she's an electrical engineer, she took the Skywarn class in St. Louis County in the fall of 2006. This was just after Hurricane Katrina. And during a break, this NOAA scientist, you know, they're a young 36 or so year old scientist, he's out there in the hallway on this break. And a big, you know, a lot of talk about hurricanes because we just had a major hurricane. And he made this statement. Just wait till you start seeing these hurricanes forming over land. Whoa, hurricanes don't form over land. That's, you can't graduate from weather school and become a meteorologist and even think that or believe that. My friend tried to answer tried to ask a follow-up question. The young NOAA scientist knew that if he said anything else, his career and pension would be at risk, so he shut up right then. But we've since seen at least one hurricane over Oklahoma. It was about a year ago. The classic cyclonic-type storm, about 50 to 100 miles wide with a well-formed eye and winds in excess of 75 miles an hour. That's the definition of a hurricane. Cyclonic storm covers a wide area with a well-formed eye and winds in excess of 75 miles an hour. Over Oklahoma about a year ago in 2007. One of the things about the modern age is anybody with internet access can watch in real time on radar as these things are happening. And my friends who are involved in construction and any outdoor activity, they watch that radar every day because it affects their livelihood. And tens of thousands of people saw this event, this hurricane over land. Do we have any other questions out there that have been written down and to be handed up front? We don't? Okay. I'll make sure I get over all these questions here. I think I have. Altitudes are safe places. I've touched on this several times, but once again, the U.S. Navy, not John Moore, the U.S. Navy says that the Missouri-Arkansas Ozarks could become a series of islands. That's pretty scary. Out where I live, the low points are 800 feet above sea level and the high points are 1,200 feet above sea level. Thinking of my neighborhood as becoming a series of islands is very scary. That, however, is what the U.S. Navy says. There's a book I'm going to recommend. It's in your bibliography on your paper, but for those watching this tape, it'll be helpful. The title of it is Patriots Surviving the Coming Collapse by James Wesley Rawls, R-A-W-L-E-S. Patriots Surviving the Coming Collapse by James Wesley Rawls. The collapse he describes is caused by economic problems. However, the book is often described as a survival manual disguised as a novel. The advice he gives and the scenarios that take place are very, very likely to be happening in real life. That's why I recommend the book. There's another Hollywood film that I sometimes refer people to, Kevin Costner film, The Postman. They really don't explain what caused the problems with the Holocaust of the postman and the crisis. However, you'll see if you watch the film, the actor, Kevin Costner, coming across what looks like a medieval English village. The way people dress, the way people live. He also comes across fortified towns and villages. In a severe long-term crisis, the federal government will still exist, and the federal government will still think they exercise control. The federal government will exercise control as far as their fence goes. That's what they'll exercise control over. State governments, pretty much the same way. Government in a long-term severe crisis will be at the county level. In fact, up until the Great Depression in the 1930s, that's what government was for most people in this country. And once you get 60 or 100 miles away from these cities, government for most people is still the county government. County government will once again be king of the hill. If there's any services provided by any government, it will be at the county level in a long-term severe crisis. Something I need to mention, and it's in my article, No Need for Panic, is the I-35 corridor. Typically, the public arguments go one of two ways. There's a Chamber of Commerce argument that the I-35 corridor, which goes from the Mexican border to Canada, will be good for commerce and good for business. There's a patriot community argument that it's going to be foreign contractors, it will hurt our sovereignty, and it will be bad for America. What neither side is talking about, why are they building this thing in the first place? Why are they building a 10-lane highway and two rail lines and fiber optics and pipelines in the first place? Why are they doing it? That's not addressed publicly. I believe I know the answer. The reason they're building it, and they are building it right now, is because they're going to need it. The reason they're going to need it is because existing infrastructure that moves heavy, bulky goods is going to be broken, damaged, and destroyed. Right now, That part of the world country, by the way, is grain country. Corn, soybeans, and wheat. It's the most productive farmland on the planet. There's nothing else that even comes close. Those heavy, bulky items, corn, wheat, and soybeans, a lot of it's moved right now by trains and by barge, river barge. Well, if the train rails are disrupted and broken, if the rivers are 50 miles wide, you don't have locks and dams on rivers 50 miles wide. They're going to have to have another way to move the heavy, bulky items through this country. And that's why they're building it. They're building it because they're going to need it. That's why they're building it. They're building it because they're going to need it. They're going to need it because existing infrastructure is going to be broken, damaged, and destroyed. I want to talk a little bit more about communications because it is so essential in a I have to keep coming back to this. Using professional-grade two-way radios is not like picking up your cell phone. It isn't. There's things you have to learn and things you have to know if you want to use and be effective with professional-grade two-way radio communications. A lot of people are hesitant to get one more government authority in their back pocket, and I don't blame you. I don't like to do that either. You don't need to become a licensed ham radio operator to get the skills of a licensed ham radio operator. The skills are what you need. The little card that says you can talk legally, it's nice to have, but it's not mandatory. I urge people to get those skills and to find people who have those skills to network with them and get the training necessary so you can get the equipment and be effective and be able to talk to your loved ones, and they can tell you they're okay, you can tell them you're okay, and one can ask the other for help if and when you may need that help. The time we've got, I really can't stand here and tell you precisely. Do we have 21 months? I hope so. As far as earth changes being severe, we probably do. In terms of other potential crises, there may be timelines and dates marked on calendars, but they haven't told me. This economy is in severe trouble. One of the foundational parts of our economy is major banks loaning money to other major banks. That's not happening. That's pretty much stopped if you've been paying attention. Tax-free municipal bonds, the place you park money for widows and orphans. AAA-rated tax-free municipal bonds. Rated by Moody's. People don't trust the AAA rating anymore. Cities wanting to build new water projects, roads, sewers, whatever it might be, are having to offer 17 and 18% interest to get people to buy their tax-free municipal bonds. And they aren't doing it. They can't afford to pay that kind of interest and build new infrastructure in that manner. They simply can't do it. There's a lot of foundational things about our economy that are at severe risk right now in March of 2008. The apparent solution is to create more money, which will make the crisis longer and worse, but that has been the decision, and they're going to stick to it. They're not going to change that decision. My advice to people is to focus on the local, focus on what you can do to help protect your family and your loved ones. I get people calling me on the radio, on my radio show all the time, asking about little hints here and there about what will help make their family safer. Should I move here? Should I move there? Well, you folks need to make your own decision about what's going to be safe for you. I'm not going to make that decision for you. Even if you bring me in as a private consultant, I won't make that decision for you. I will tell you what the possibilities are. I will tell you what to look out for. And then the decision is up to you as to what you'll be doing, how you will do it, why you will do it, how much money you're going to spend. Under normal conditions, under normal circumstances, it takes about a year from the first time you say, Mr. Contractor, I want to make an appointment with you, until he hands you the key that you can move into your new home, whether it's an earth-sheltered concrete home or a regular home out here in the suburbs. It's typically about 1 year. So that's your window. And after that, No matter how much money you've got, it will be very, very difficult to get anything done in less than a year. Granted, money talks. That's an old saying, and there's a lot of truth to it. I know some of these contractors that specialize in these monolithic concrete domes and earth-sheltered homes, and they typically have a backlog of 6 to 8 months of homes to build because there aren't that many of them doing. Point being, ladies and gentlemen, whenever you folks are out there watching us tape in the future, if you have the financial resources and want to build something, you need to figure on about 12 months from the time you make that first call until the time the contractor hands you the keys and you're ready to move in. There's websites on the handout there, no need for panic, listed at the back. Mr. Rawls, the author of the book I mentioned, he has a website, Survival Blog, and we're going to include some of these websites on the tape here at the end so people can watch them. Survivalblog.com. Excellent website. I highly recommend it. The radio station that I'm on, Republic Broadcasting, has a number of talk show hosts that deal with all kinds of topics. The man on the show before mine on Sunday afternoon, focuses on preparedness. We have other talk show hosts to talk a lot about health-related topics and, of course, the geopolitical matters. There's a lot of education you can get from listening to talk radio. And I urge people to get as much education as they can in the time that remains. There is a story, and I'm not sure if it's true or not, not that it matters. And shortly after John Kennedy came to office, he got a private audience with the Pope. And that's publicly documented and well known. It's believed that the Pope revealed some secrets to President Kennedy at that meeting. Because when President Kennedy came back, he started implementing executive orders that had to do with preparedness. Of course, at the time, we were just coming out of the Cold War, and people thought it was Cold War related. Made sense at the time. The Vatican and the Vatican Library has records going back millennia, literally millennia. There's a belief, and it's based on some evidence, and we've all heard this story, about the ancient library at Alexandria, Egypt, and how the Romans burned that library. There's some evidence that when the Roman government did that, they took all the valuable stuff, the books on engineering, mathematics, medicine. They took all that back to Rome. And what they burned to heat the Roman baths for months was the books that nobody cared about, old tax records and a bunch of stuff that had been lying around for centuries, literally. They burned that stuff up. Roman government has had an intelligence service like all governments do. They took it back and they kept it. And when the Roman government was about to collapse, the Vatican government took it over, took custody of all those documents from the library at Alexandria, Egypt. They've had them ever since. They've known, because they've had the records, what was coming at us, both from the Bible and from other written records of other cultures. They've known what was coming at us. And they apparently warned, President Kennedy about what was coming at us. And whether it was because of the Cold War or because of what he learned from the Pope, President Kennedy began implementing the emergency preparations at the federal government level back then in the early 1960s. And those preparations have continued to this day. Back in the mid to late 1990s, there was some public attention to shelters being built by the Russians. And it didn't make any sense. Well, the Cold War is over, the Soviet Union's collapsed, we got democracy in Russia. Why are they building these shelters that could house tens of thousands of people in the Ural Mountains, or literally cut the middle of a mountain in the Ural Mountains? Why are they doing that now? It didn't make any sense. Well, now it makes sense. They need to shelter their people too. It's the nature of any large organization to want to take care of their own people. And the Russians, of course, are doing that as well. Talk about the Chinese a little bit. The maps I've seen of what Asia will look like after these ocean levels come up show China losing a substantial part of their agricultural land, the land that they grow food on to feed more than 1 billion people. They're still going to want to do that, even though they've lost all that land. There's a very good possibility, and once again, it's backed up by evidence. A friend of mine who's still active in the military, he got on a Black Hawk helicopter at MacDill Air Force Base. This is very recently, last 3 or 4 years. Flew across the Gulf of Mexico to Mexico, to the country of Mexico, and got off the Black Hawk helicopter at a Russian military base in Mexico. My same friend, when he was in Bosnia, he was a liaison with Spetsnaz, the Russian Special Forces. And he says, John, these guys, they speak English with a neutral Midwestern accent, they train with American uniforms, and they brag about confiscating firearms in Bosnia as practice for what they'll be doing in the United States. There is evidence that both Russia and China fully intend to invade the United States and capture the heartland, the grain-growing area. The grain-growing area will be mostly, largely, unaffected by these earth changes unless Yellowstone blows its top, which that would take out about a fourth of it, more or less. Otherwise, the grain-growing area of this country will be largely unaffected, and that's still very special. It's still very important, the ability to have hundreds of thousands of acres that can grow corn, wheat, and soybeans. Extremely important. The information I'm getting from private sources tells me that both the Russians and the Chinese are doing the logistical planning, the logistical stockpiling that I'd be doing. If I was planning an invasion, I'd be doing exactly what they're doing, prepositioning supplies in Mexico and Canada. That appears to be exactly what's going on. As we all learned from watching the first Gulf War, it took better part of a year to move in all the logistical things that we needed to fight a war, and then about a month to cycle the men in these large transport planes. So that's what they're doing, ladies and gentlemen, based on the information that I'm getting from my private sources. I don't know what else I can tell you. I've answered every question that I'm aware of. If more questions come up, you've got my phone number on the front of my article there, no need for panic. I am reachable for private consultations. I do a radio show 2 hours a week on Republic Broadcasting from 4 to 6 p.m. is my current time slot on Sunday afternoons. My passion is to help people be safe. I've seen the consequences of not being prepared. I've seen violent death firsthand. I've smelled the bombs. I've seen the bleeding bodies. I've heard the screams of the people dying in agony. And it's not a fun place to be. My passion is to see people be safe. And I'll do anything I can to help people be safe and be prepared. That's my passion. That's why I'm up here doing this. And with that, I will ask that God bless you all and that God bless this country. And thank you very much.